I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Zerubbabel writes in the preface to his new book that he grew up in a home where every single room housed some unmentionable elephant. He writes, "I was always surrounded by open secrets that, although widely known, nevertheless remained unspoken." His book is called The Elephant in the Room, subtitled Silence and Denial in Everyday Life. Zerubbabel gives many examples where people collaborate in denying the obvious. They are often, he says, driven by fear and shame. He points to genocide, sexual abuse, political and corporate scandals, even the military's don't ask, don't tell policy to underscore how common and complex denial is. Avyatar Zerubbabel also highlights the work of whistleblowers and silence breakers like the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo, who exposed Argentina's dirty war and forced that country to face the truth about itself. Avyatar Zerubbabel is a professor of sociology at Rutgers University, their New Brunswick campus, and joins us this morning here in our Philadelphia studios. And a great pleasure to have you with us. Good morning.
Thank you, Marty. Good morning.
Good morning to you. I'm curious about those elephants that you grew up with. And as you said in your book, grew up with every single room in your house housed some big elephant.
Yeah, it was an apartment. So it was a four-room apartment that housed two grandparents, my parents and myself, and there were a lot of tensions and communication patterns in this family, which were very weird, and nobody spoke about them, nobody spoke about the weirdness, and it took me many years to realize that, first of all, it's something that happens in many families, but also that the idiosyncrasies of these particular patterns affected me as a person myself growing up.
And I'm curious, I don't want to put you on the psychiatrist couch here, but in what sort of ways? Because I can imagine if you grew up in a house where there were generational secrets, but things that people couldn't talk about, but everyone knew about.
Yeah, well, the one main thing was that one of the members of this family, my grandfather, was in a situation where my grandmother and my mother didn't talk to him for many years. And as a child, I grew up into such a family. Nobody told me that I'm not talking with him, but I could see it, but it was not discussed. So this is the situation of a conspiracy of silence where there is lack of communication, and then there is lack of communication about the fact that there's lack of communication.
Kind of a double silence.
Exactly,
there.
Which is why I call it a meta-silence, silence about silence.
This was, as you say, your childhood. Is this whole sort of question about denial and silence, has that been then working on you all these decades to write this book?
Yeah, well, I also experienced it at a societal level. I grew up in Tel Aviv, in Israel. I was born in 1948, so I was born right into immediately the post-independence period, and there were a lot of leftovers from the pre-1948 period that were not talked about. Mm-hmm. The presence, for example, of Arabs in what is now Tel Aviv, and there were neighborhoods that had Arabic names, but I never had any explicit discourse with anybody about why they have these weird Arabic names. And then I discovered the very same patterns at the organizational level, at the workplace, where there are certain things that are problematic presences in organizations, in the workplace, and people don't talk about them. Mm-hmm. And they may talk about them on a one-on-one level, but not publicly.
Your book begins with the well-known story of the emperor's new clothes as an example of silence, I guess, the silence about the silence, the power dynamic when someone who's very powerful says or sees something that doesn't exist, but the pressure on everyone else to go along with their view of the world.
Right. You mentioned the power element. It's very important because one of the first things that occurred to me about this story is that it could have only been about an emperor. It couldn't have been about one of the servants. There couldn't be the servant's new clothes, because there wouldn't be the element of fear and there wouldn't be the element of shame in the same way. And right before I started working on this book, I also witnessed, on the media, what was going on in the White House around the whole Monica Gate. Mm-hmm. And there was something very similar, where the emperor had no clothes, almost literally, and yet there was a lot of difficulty talking about it, and there were a lot of people around him who knew very well what was going on, but didn't talk about it in public as a group.
You talk about how, and we're talking about silence and denial in these sort of larger context, as not as individuals, but as groups or even as a society. But you talk about the power of fear and shame driving some of this denial and silence. How does that work on a more sort of sociological level?
Part of what happens is that there's a kind of an element of reverberation. Let's say if you and I are sitting and talking, and something happens in the room. Someone passes, there's a certain sound, a certain smell, and one of us doesn't acknowledge mm-hmm. the presence of that thing. Well, the other is looking, I look at you, you don't seem to notice, so I pretend that I don't notice it as well. Well, at the same time, you're looking at me, you see that I don't notice it, so it goes back to you. That's exactly what happens in the emperor's new clothes, because it's the ministers, the advisors, who start pretending that there's that beautiful robe, and the emperor, seeing them, says, well, it must be there, I'm just stupid and I don't see it, so I'll say that I see it. And when he says that it's so great, they they are even more convinced that it's there.
And so they convince each other
exactly.
that something that isn't true is true, or something that is true isn't.
Exactly. And beyond that, what's very interesting is that I'm dealing in this book with a phenomenon that we call open secrets. And unlike ordinary secrets, which are kept, are much more tightly guarded, the less people there are, open secrets are much more tightly guarded, the more people around there are, because it's much harder to break the silence when there are 50 people around, all of whom seem to ignore it, than when there are just two.
And is that just because the power that a group exerts on itself or on the members of the group, so that there is a kind of group think that happens?
I think it's group pressure, and there's also the issue of uncorroborated evidence. Let's take, for example, a three-year-old child. Okay, I'm thinking of myself in the situation that I described. I saw strange things, but I didn't have anyone to talk about them with. It happens a lot of times when there is someone who is terminally ill in the family. It happens when there is incest in the family, when there is any other form of domestic violence, when there is alcohol or any other drug abuse. And what happens is that, I'm thinking again of the young, very young children, they see the evidence, but it's not corroborated, and they start doubting, first of all, whether what they are seeing is actually there, and also if they feel that it's wrong, that it's actually wrong. Because one of the things that happens when you are watching something that is wrong and nobody says anything is that you start normalizing the wrongdoing.
Meaning that, and then you don't trust your own eyes, right?
I mean, you don't trust your own eyes, and you don't trust your own sense of morality. Because let's say, for example, that you're in a situation in the military, and there are certain rules of military conduct that everyone should follow, and you see that your commander, for example, doesn't follow them, but nobody around you dares to say anything about it, so you start thinking, well, maybe it is all right. And that's where the groupthink operates.
Which makes you think about then the kind of courage then that either a whistleblower or, as you say, a silence breaker has to have in order to go against this group dynamic, in order to say, like in The King's New Clothes, the king isn't wearing any new clothes.
Definitely. You mentioned the whistleblower, and I want to just make a very clear distinction between breaking the silence and blowing the whistle. Whistleblowers reveal skeletons. Silence breakers reveal elephants. There's a big difference between elephants and skeletons in that skeletons are in the backstage. They're in the closet. Elephants are in the room, in the background rather than the backstage. So they are seen, they are heard, and yet they are not acknowledged. But as far as the courage to break either of those, I think it takes a lot of courage. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that you are in the minority statistically. If there are 45 people around me and nobody is mentioning something, it would take a lot of courage on my part to mention it, or stupidity. And sometimes it's the same thing.
Well, as you were talking about this, and frankly, as I was reading the book yesterday, though, I was thinking about the role that comedians can play in breaking either the silence or almost being a whistleblower. Oh, I guess it's more, now I'm thinking skeletons and elephants. Let's say that they are breaking the silence, that they are acknowledging the elephants in the room. And I'm thinking about Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert, two broadcasters I have tremendous regard for, who I think, you know, expose all the sort of pomposity and in many cases, the lies that either show up in the news or show up at press conferences that everyone buys into.
Definitely. I think that humor is one of the most interesting ways in which silence is broken, especially at the larger societal level. One of the instances that I mention in the book is something that fascinated me. I always wondered how the Germans feel for the 12 years of being ruled by the Third Reich about the fact that the racial ideology, racist ideology, was about pure Aryanship and how a pure Aryan should look. And none of these people who advocated that
looked like that.
And I found that in 1933 or 4, right after they came to power, there was a joke going around, how does an ideal German look? As tall as Goebbels, as blonde as Hitler, and as slim as Goering. And I just think that it's very interesting that at that stage you could tell such jokes. I just wonder whether 6, 7, 8 years later people would tell such jokes. And, I'm thinking of people like Bill Maher. I'm thinking of Michael Moore. These are people, you know, around us who actually reveal elephants. I'm saying reveal in the sense that the elephants are there to see,
exactly,
but you have to foreground them because they're in the background. And the act of foregrounding is to not take as a given the thing that we are conventionally used to take as a given. And that takes not only courage, but also a lot of cognitive creativity, because a lot of our cognitive tranquility is based on the fact that we say certain things we put in parentheses, we put in the background, and other stuff we bring out.
And I want to pick up on that cognitive tranquility. Aviatar Zerubbabel is our guest today on Radio Times, and we're talking about his new book. It's entitled The Elephant in the Room, subtitled Silence and Denial in Everyday Life. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Give us a call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the 21st Annual Mushroom Festival, a celebration of the mushroom heritage of Kennett Square, Pennsylvania, on Saturday, September 9th and Sunday, September 10th, featuring mushroom cooking demonstrations from celebrity chefs, the Amateur Mushroom Soup Cook-Off, street festival with more than 160 vendors, live music and dancing, the Mushroom Festival Community Parade, and more. Directions and schedule of events are available online at www.mushroomfestival.org.
I'm crazy. On the next Fresh Air, we wrap up our country music series. Willie Nelson tells us about his songs and his book, The Tao of Willie. Also, James Hand explains why it took him until age 53 to release his debut album. Join us on Labor Day for the next Fresh Air.
Crazy. This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
We all want to be happy, but do we really understand what will bring us happiness? I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices from the Family, we'll hear from Harvard psychologist Daniel Gilbert, who says that we're wrong about what makes us happy all of the time. We'll discuss Gilbert's new book, Stumbling on Happiness, and find out how our brains actually cook the books when it comes to predicting future emotions. That's today at noon, right here on WHYY 91 FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're just joining us, our guest is Avyatar Zerubbabel. He's a professor of sociology at Rutgers University, the author of several books, including a new one called The Elephant in the Room, Silence and Denial in Everyday Life. We invited him to join us today on Radio Times to talk about how silence and denial work and work on a sort of a large sociological level. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You talked right before the break about disturbing the cognitive tranquility. This is something that you describe that happens when people sort of, I guess, believe something together that isn't true, right?
Yeah. I'm actually drawing here on a very common and fascinating distinction that psychologists have made almost a century ago between figure and ground, that when you look at a certain situation, there are certain things that you notice actively and there are other things that you put in the background because we can't just process everything. Well, the same thing happens at a social level when a group, whether it's two people or an entire society, make a decision, often, most times, an implicit decision, certain deal, to bracket certain things and put them in the background and in a way, not deal with them even though they are there. Mm. What silence breakers do is, in a way, reverse the relationship between figure and ground. They take the elephant that is all the time there, but in the background, and they say, here it is. Mm. For example, In the second or third chapter of Genesis, there's a very interesting story of the Garden of Eden, where Adam and Eve eat from the tree of knowledge. Well, what happens when they eat from the tree of knowledge? The first thing they notice is that they are naked and they cover themselves. Well, they saw that they were naked before. It's not anything new factually, and yet they focus on that. And that's when the nudity becomes disturbing. So I'm arguing in the book that the same thing happens whenever you break the silence. You're not revealing anything that people didn't know. Unlike whistleblowers who actually tell us about things we didn't know, silence breakers tell us the things that we know, but we didn't talk about.
You had mentioned during the break that Anita Hill, using your example, is both a silence breaker and a whistleblower.
Yeah.
In her testimony of, what, I don't know, 10 years ago, I guess, or even more.
More. Because Anita Hill was presented as a whistleblower almost par excellence in the sense that she blew the whistle on a candidate for the Supreme Court. And she told us things we didn't know about him. But beyond that, she was also a silence breaker, is that she started talking explicitly about sexual harassment at the workplace, which was something that people always knew, but they didn't talk about in the same way. So in that case, she operates both as a silence breaker, as a whistleblower. The distinction is much more analytical than empirical, and I make the distinction for those purposes. But sometimes, as in the case of... But if you take the case of someone like Emile Zola, for example, during the Dreyfus, right after the Dreyfus trial, what's interesting there is that it's pure silence breaking. He didn't tell France anything that the French didn't know. He just say, I accuse us, right? For not talking about this and this and that.
And the Dreyfus affair finally by France, I guess, getting some recognition or acknowledgement now, what, in 2006?
Yeah.
Talk, though, a bit about, and you write a bit about, tact, courtesy, politeness, that sometimes, and maybe this is more interpersonal, is that people don't say what's obvious because they're just being polite.
Yeah.
They're not going to say, look at that monstrously fat person over there, for instance.
Yeah, one of the interesting things that I found is that in my reading, I realized that nobody has ever made the connection between tact and taboo, as if these are two entirely separate themes. And actually, I see one as the soft or hard version of the other, because they operate on the same principle of avoidance. And the question is the avoidance a kind of a road sign that says you shouldn't enter? Or is it a road sign that says, well, start, just be careful not to, something like that. Tact is presented in a very positive way as, one of the foundations
manners,
of social
right?
etiquette, right? And if you look at any etiquette book, you're going to see don't talk about this, don't stare at this, and so on. But an extreme version of this is going to be what requires participation in conspiracies of silence. I mean, I actually insisted on having on the cover of the book the famous three monkeys of the see no evil, hear no evil, and speak no evil, because to me they capture the systemic nature of conspiracies of silence. And what we should note about all three of them is that they're very tactful.
That's right. They don't hurt anybody's feelings. But I wonder whether you're also saying that, and again, we're speaking on a more sociological level, is that there should be no secrets, that everything should be known by everyone. We should acknowledge, everything that comes across our vision, our perspective.
I wish it were that simple. I think it's much more complex, and I end the book with two chapters, one of which I called, some things are better not talked about, and the other is titled The Trouble with Elephants. And I think we have to deal with the complexity of the fact that both the positives and the negatives coexist there. Sometimes the positives in the short run are the negatives in the long run. No social relationship between two persons or within an entire society would be possible if we said everything that is on our mind that is also clear to the other. I'm talking about hurting, I'm talking about face saving, But at the same time, the price that we pay is enormous, and I think that both should be acknowledged. So, no, I'm not advocating that everything should be talked about, but I want us to recognize what is the price that we pay by being tactful and not talking about.
I've interviewed people and have heard more than one say, and this often is a reference to the Vietnam War, is that one of the party has served in the war, comes back, and it's not a topic of conversation. My analysis is that each one is protecting the other. The one that was there doesn't want the one who wasn't there to know what they went through, and the other one wants to respect their desire to keep this part of their life secret. I wonder how you sort of negotiate or navigate through something like that.
Yeah, actually, another classic example, which has been written about and theorized, is the case of the Holocaust. Not only while it was happening, because while it was happening, there was a lot of conspiracy of silence, for example, in communities that saw a lot of Jews being, hoarded into trucks and trains and so on, and never seen again, and yet not talking about where could they go, but also among Jewish communities that heard rumors of what would be going on later and still preferred to deny it. But even more interesting is what happened after the Holocaust at the level of the family. And this has been studied. For example, there is a psychologist, Dan Barone, who coined a very useful term, I found, of the double wall of silence. Double in the sense that both sides need it. So he started by studying families of Nazi perpetrators and then moved to study families of their victims. And the pattern, the dynamic, was exactly the same.
Oh, that's fascinating.
The ones who went through the experience didn't want to talk about it, either because of shame or because of pain. And then their families didn't want to violate their privacy. They also didn't want to know at some level.
Of course.
And it's this tension between wanting to know, not wanting to know, wanting to tell, not wanting to tell. And that's exactly the land landscape that I'm trying to describe in the book.
You're describing it. I mean, you don't offer a one way out of this, but I know you're not here to say that this is what people should do when there's been some horrendous trauma in their family. But you're saying it. What happens by not talking about it is this great, I guess, turmoil and angst within this particular unit.
Right. I'm thinking, for example, of. I've been reading a lot about what was happening in Argentina during the Dirty War, the famous disappearances. The disappearances happened in a climate of silence. People who saw people being abducted from home and being taken into cars and never seen again wouldn't talk about it. They might talk about it on a one-on-one level, but not in public until their mothers and grandmothers started marching in the Plaza de Mayo. Well, I'm trying to put myself in their situation and thinking, what would I do then? And I don't know what I would do, because I would like to say that it's precisely the silence that allowed for those things. If people were just marching, and saying this is unacceptable, maybe it wouldn't have happened. But the question is, would I have the strength to do it? And one of the ways that silence works on the part of silencers is the divide and rule principle. I'm thinking, for example, of pedophile priests. Okay, I'm thinking of serial molesters who would molest several boys in the very same parish. Each of those boys didn't know about the others.
That's right.
Some of those boys did tell their families, and their families might tell the bishop or not. But the interesting thing is that only the molesting priest knew about the multiplicity of those cases. None of them knew about the others. And it's if they did know about the others, they would feel much more comfortable to talk about it. One of the prices that we pay for the conspiracies of silence is the loneliness. Because, for example, one of the cases that I found striking was that I'm thinking of Betty Friedan writing The Feminine Mystique and opening it with a chapter, The Problem with No Name.
Huh.
And this namelessness, whether it's namelessness or euphemism, and you mentioned in the case of tact, it's very often euphemisms, she noted that a lot of unhappy housewives thought that there is some problem with them. Well, if they didn't know that others are just as unhappy, it wouldn't have been such a problem.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Aviatar Zerubbabel, our guest today on Radio Times. He's a professor of sociology at Rutgers University, and we're talking about his new book. It's called The Elephant in the Room, Silence and Denial in Everyday Life. It's interesting, a little bit complicated, but certainly worth talking about. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I'm thinking, though, about language, the power of language, and also language and silence, because I know with the Bush administration that they didn't use the word insurgent to describe the what we now call and see as insurgent violence in Iraq for, I think, more than a year. That word, they didn't want to apply that label to what was going on there. And do you find that even looking at silence and denial, that it can come down to a word, that somehow by not using a word, then something isn't happening?
Definitely. And this is something that George Orwell in 1984 was so sensitive to. And when he talks about the principles of newspeak, he does talk about the fact that when you remove certain words from the language, for example, certain ideas can't be expressed. I think that what you're saying about the insurgency in Iraq is a perfect example. I think an even better example would be the words that are not used yet in public discourse, but only by few, which is civil war.
Mm.
When do you start calling this civil war? If every day there are 80 people, 100 people being killed, and it is around sectarian war, why wouldn't you call it a civil war? But of course, by calling it a civil war on the part of the administration, that would be admitting such big, colossal failure.
And you're saying then by saying that, by naming it, then it sort of telegraphs to other people that this is the reality of precisely, what we're dealing with.
Precisely. I think that one of the things that silence breakers do is name the unnamed, is not use euphemisms or leave things nameless, but actually name them explicitly. Because once you do, and again, to take the case of the Emperor's New Clothes, the story, when the little boy says the Emperor has no clothes, he's actually articulating explicitly something that everyone around sees and knows, and yet they've not articulated publicly. They've not acknowledged it. So it's actually this tension between knowledge and acknowledgement. Just because you know something, I mean, they come from the same root, but they are very different things. It's a difference between awareness and discourse.
Let me throw something out on the table, and then we'll get some callers in on the conversation, because you also talk about the don't ask, don't tell policy of the Clinton administration to deal with gays in the military. How does that fit into our discussion about silence and denial?
It fits into the three monkeys and into the, you know, what I was saying about the double wall of silence. The silence that you see in conspiracies of silence is systemic. It's enacted not by individuals, but by social systems. Mm-hmm. The three monkeys, and actually I think there should be many more than three, because there's a kind of asymmetry. The hear no evil and speak no evil are interrelated, but the see no evil should also have another one, which is show no evil. Hmm. Because the...
I wonder what that monkey would look like. But
well,
yes, go ahead.
It should be, for example, every one of us who refrains from being an exhibitionist is a show no evil monkey. Mm. And that helps the see no evil monkey to see no evil.
Right.
But if I keep showing and you pretend not to see, I make it very difficult for you. One of the things that we haven't touched, which I think are very important, is the response to silence breakers, which is most often very negative.
Hostility.
And one of the reasons that happens, one of them, is that by exposing the elephant explicitly, I make it very difficult for those around me to keep pretending that it's not there.
Mm. And with the don't ask, don't tell, what it says is, yes, we know there are gays in the military, but we're going to tolerate them, but we're not going to acknowledge them, and they can't tell us who they are.
Right, and I actually think that I use it throughout the book, but I think it's a weak example of a conspiracy of silence in the sense that you don't have the meta-silence. You don't have the silence about the silence. When you have a policy that is explicitly called don't ask, don't tell,
right,
there is an acknowledgement of the fact that we don't talk about it, but it's there. Much, much more insidious are the conspiracies of silence when there is the meta-silence, when we are silent about the fact that we're silent.
My head just exploded. Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take another short break and get back to our conversation. And interested in hearing from our listeners what you think about this power of silence and denial in everyday life. And that's the subtitle of our guest's new book. The book is called The Elephant in the Room. And his name is Aviatar Zerubbabel. He's a professor of sociology at Rutgers University at their New Brunswick campus, and he's written several other books dealing with some interesting sociological issues, this one, of course, having to do with silence and denial. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Ballet X supports WHYY and presents choreographer Yorma Elo and Pennsylvania Ballet's Matthew Neenan at the Philadelphia Live Arts Festival, September 6th through 10th, 215-413-1318 or livearts-fringe.org.
Hi, I'm George, hoping you'll join me for the next edition of Crazy College when we hit the books as the new school year begins. We'll be auditing a course in comedy with Professor Tom Lehrer. Chubby Checker goes to the head of the class with Randy Newman, and Soupy Sales thinks that the varsity is a drag when the Happiness Boys go collegiate. All that and then some, next time, when Crazy College heads back to school.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY. Next time on Day to Day, I scream, you scream. We all know what to scream for, but what kind do you like?
Orange blossom.
Chocolate martini.
Lavender.
Banana. Lucuma.
What's lucuma?
What's the fruit?
This neck of the woods, people are very adventurous. They want us to push it.
And you thought 31 flavors were a lot to handle. Sample some of LA's most exotic ice cream boutiques.
Wow.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The teachers and school support professionals of the Pennsylvania State Education Association are pleased to underwrite Public Radio Capital News with features, analysis, and news from the state capital, PSEA, Leadership for Public Education.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and we're talking today on the show. In fact, if you're just joining us, our guest is Avietar Zerubbabel, and he's written an interesting book. It's called The Elephant in the Room, Silence and Denial in Everyday Life. And it's a look at how and why and the consequences of pretending to ignore a truth that we all know. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Why? Let me get Jim from Conshohocken to join us. Hi, Jim. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Marty. Hi, Dr. Zerubbabel.
Hi.
Hi. I just want to make a point. I think that whistleblowing really does work. I've had personal experience with that. And there was a church I used to belong to in Philadelphia that had some very controversial practices. They told people, you know, basically where to work, who to date, things like that. This went on for a while. Now what happened was is one of the leaders of the church wrote a letter which was meant for other leaders, and it went on the internet, and it basically pointed out a lot of the abuses, mm-hmm. and it brought up a lot of the concerns that members had. And basically what happened is the church had some open forums where they had the members come in and say how they felt, and it really worked. It really worked very well. The church kind of stopped a lot of the things they were doing. One of the things they were doing is getting money from members. This like a, you know, like how you give money to a church.
Sure, sure.
They stopped demanding it, and they basically let people just give freely. And it's a lot different now.
Well, that's an interesting story there, Jim. I appreciate you calling into Radio Times. But to you, our guest, this is something that showed up on the internet, and I wanted to ask you whether you think the internet is a silence breaker, maybe even a whistleblower at times.
I think it's an excellent question, because this is a relatively new mode of communication, a form of communication. I'm not sure we are fully understanding yet. And I think it's also a form of communication that is involving in terms mm-hmm. of what's the etiquette and so on.
And what's even true or not true on the internet.
Right.
Yeah.
But I do think that there is a big difference between exposing something on the internet and exposing it face to face. I still think that the elements of shame and fear that I keep talking about in the mm-hmm. book are much, much more strongly felt at the face to face level than in the internet. But nevertheless, the internet also has a certain air, a certain climate of openness about it, which is, of course, all about not keeping things
exactly.
unspoken.
Exactly. And it is largely anonymous. And I'm
yes.
assuming that sort of helps in this open exchange of ideas, as you don't know who it is you're talking with or exchanging information with.
Definitely. Actually, in the case of whistleblowing, a lot of whistleblowing comes from anonymous sources. Because precisely because of the element of fear, it's much easier to do it when your name is not, your identity is not associated with it.
You know, I want, and this is just a follow up, then we'll go back to our callers, because as I was preparing for the show, I was also thinking about how we are also a very confessional culture, a very blabby culture. I mean, there are TV shows that have, you know, made millions of dollars with people confessing all sorts of things on the airwaves, and these people are not anonymous. How do you look at that in this context of silence and
yeah,
denial?
Definitely. Well, I'll say one thing. In this book, I'm trying to lay out the fundamental dynamics of that underlie conspiracies of silence, but I would, and I'm trying to give examples from very different contexts, but I would say, as any social scientist would have to say, that there are going to be a lot of differences between different contexts, and especially when you do it cross-culturally. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right about cultures like the American culture that, and again, you know, there are regional differences. People in the Appalachians are not as talkative necessarily as people in New York, but again, when you take American culture in general and you compare it, for example, with Japanese culture, now, what's interesting...
And we're assumed much more blabby than the Japanese culture.
Definitely, yeah, definitely. Yeah. But aside from that, there's also the issue of different cultures might differ in terms of what are the subjects that are going to be taboo. For example, I've been living in the American culture now for 34 years. I remember that when I came from Israel, where I grew up, I was astonished that people's income is something that that is not mentioned.
That's even in the States.
Yeah, even among pretty close friends, right. Which was something that surprised me. But this is about the content of, you know, what it is that we don't talk about. The contrast between the American and the Japanese culture, I would say, is also in how much is not being talked about, right. Period.
And let me get back to our callers. We've got Michelle from Monroe, New Jersey. Hi, Michelle. Go ahead, your radio times.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
This is extraordinarily interesting. On several levels, I am so delighted about this conversation. One, personal and some local political levels, and actually national. But I'm going to go backwards.
Well, you know what, Michelle, just take one, only because we've got other callers.
The issue of the American self-image, and I think versus the issue of not being able to discuss our role in torture in the world. And I just, it's very disturbing that even people I respect, my friends, my colleagues, can't have a discussion about it. No one really wants to talk about it. And I just feel somehow, as a culture, we're complicit if we at least don't have the discussion.
And this would be related to torture memos and allegations,
right,
of torture.
And it seems like an awful big elephant in the room to me. I mean, no one wants to really accept that these memos are true, and people are, I mean, even just getting into the Iraq war, with all of the information now that's come, people still don't want to talk about, well, gee, maybe we've made a mistake. I mean, on a personal level, in my daily life, it seems that people are really afraid to have that discussion.
Oh, that's interesting. And Michelle, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, one comment I would make is that we should also distinguish between public discourse in the media and public discourse other than that. Just as I said about the difference between the internet and the face-to-face. In the media, at least in the liberal media, there's a lot of discourse now around torture, but I don't see it at the smaller scale level of between friends, in the workplace and so on. So I totally agree with caller. The other thing, of course, that you mentioned, Michelle, is as you say about, you know, the outcome of this whole, I guess you were talking about the American invasion of Iraq, mm-hmm. and this is again where, Marty, your point about the use of language is very important, because how you call this in terms of can you say it failed, or can you say, well, there are certain aspects that fail, is going to be very, very significant.
Michelle, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But even speaking more broadly, if you break the silence, or someone breaks the silence about something, then it seems to me you have to do something about it, don't you? I mean, isn't that also why people keep silence, or even are happy to be in denial? Because then they don't have to do something about something that's so obviously this elephant in the room. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I want to sticking to the Iraq war example, mm-hmm. Talk about another aspect of it, which touches what you just asked. I remember about a year after the war, a very interesting a program of Ted Koppel on Nightline, where he actually spent the whole program, something like 40 minutes or so, doing nothing but read names of American casualties. At that time, I think there were 700 or 800 casualties, which is dwarfed by what we have now, which is more than 2,500. But at that time, it was colossal in the sense that, especially that it was just after a year after the famous mission accomplished scene, it suggested that here is something that we don't talk about because we don't look at it in its cumulative way. We know about this person here, but to add them up, now, everyone can do this addition, but Ted Koppel did a very important thing there in terms of publicly spending that time just reading those names and bringing it to them, to public discourse.
So even the fact that people could by themselves do the addition, or if they were paying attention, could keep track of that. There was something about this very public statement or this public program that broke the silence.
Exactly. And the same thing I would say about artists. For example, you know, we talked before about comedians, but mm-hmm. artists do the same thing. I know that there are on some beaches in California, Santa Monica, Santa Barbara, where there are mock cemeteries of the American casualties in this war. And they're actually, they don't have graves, they just have flags, but it's the number of flags that you see there. It's very similar to the Vietnam War Memorial.
With all the names,
is that in a way you are articulating in a relatively explicit way the number of casualties, and you look at that as a group.
Let me get Jesse from Ridley Park to join us. Michelle, thanks for the call. Jesse, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
I kind of look at this from a family perspective.
Okay.
Denial when it comes to that, and it correlates to tribal governments as well as family. The denial. I found that when you're trying to have an intervention with someone, say like a drug addict, and you bring their family in, well, I found there's two types of interventions, and there's one that works and there's one that doesn't.
Right.
And one is because one part has the family in there, which is probably the root of their problems, their struggles. Now, when it comes to governments, tribal governments are families. You have that same family structure, support system, and in dyads, dysfunctional dyads, there's resonation and attunement. And you know, resonation is that bind, and attunement is that forcing you to feel. And so when you're being forced to feel at all times, I believe it keeps your mind in a state of working memory, and you can't get to those different types of memories, like episodic memory, where you can look back and understand what you've done. And that's what actually denial is, at least from my research.
Okay, Jesse, thanks for the call.
Sure.
I'm not sure I totally understand what he's saying, but go
ahead. Well, I want to respond here and highlight a very important distinction between the psychological and sociological perspectives on denial. And to use this example that you just brought up of the intervention is a fascinating example of silence breaking. If you take any drug addiction, alcohol or other, the problem is, other than the problem of the individual, the problem for the system, for the family, has to do also with the fact that it's something that is not talked about.
Right.
And actually, the metaphor of the elephant in the room has evolved mostly originally within the context of alcoholic families. And the problem is about this presence of something very big that we are all encountering, and yet we don't talk about it. The intervention is done in a public situation. The whole point is that it's not about an individual therapy kind of context, but a context where the family members, workmates,
community,
friends,
people that are all
exactly
connected,
are coming into this, and it is acknowledged publicly.
Huh.
And I think it's one of the most fascinating ways in which silences are broken.
Well, we've been talking about the conspiracy of silence, but you also write about the conspiracy of noise.
Yes.
Speak to that, if you would.
Well, the conspiracy of noise, what I mean by it is the attempt to cover silence by talk. A lot of times when we do, you know, what we call, for example, beating around the bush.
Sure.
Or small talk. What is small talk? Instead of not talking about something, we'll talk about the weather, we'll talk. that's not breaking the silence. There is a silence there, and it's actually becoming even greater because, you know, if we talk about the weather instead of the fact that one of us just died, okay, this is something that I know happens a lot in cultures that are in denial of death, is that people come to commemorate the death of someone, then they don't mention the someone. Well, and they talk about the weather and things like that. That is a conspiracy of noise in that sense.
Well, and we began with you talking a bit about your childhood growing up in your family with all these elephants in the room. Did this book in any way sort of help you deal with some of the sort of mystery and upset of dealing with of living in a family that couldn't talk about this?
Definitely, definitely, because I think that the process of working on this book is at the third level there. You know, I talked about silence and about meta-silence, which is silence about silence. But yes, there is also meta-meta-silence, which is silence about the fact that there is meta-silence. And for me, one of the important things, I believe, in this book is to bring this phenomenon to public discourse. And I think that once we talk about the fact that we don't talk about the fact that we don't talk about something, something is happening.
Aviatar Zerubbabel, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you. My pleasure.
My pleasure, too. And the book is called The Elephant in the Room, Silence and Denial in Everyday Life, and it's published by Oxford University Press. He's a professor of sociology at Rutgers University at their New Brunswick campus. And that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. You can also go to whyy.org/Radio Times. Leave us an email. Find out more about the program, including the fact that we do offer podcasts of our program. And we've got years and years of archives at our website as well. And again, that address is whyy.org/Radio Times. Devorah Lissick, Alan Tu, Susan Greenbaum produce Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscowane, and you're listening to WHYY FM Philadelphia, serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware, and worldwide at WHYY.org. I first spoke with Aviatar Zerubbabel earlier this summer. Coming up, a conversation with Ken Dornstein about his new book. It's called The Boy Who Fell Out of the Sky. We're